608-263-0808. In Alaska and Wisconsin, call 608-263-4892. Our technical director is Dennis Nielsen. I'm Ann Bozell.
Support for this program is provided by
Concert tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock with Joan Morris and Bill Bolcom performing in our music studios, and I hope you can tune in. It's 3 minutes after 4 o'clock. Anantnagar is the biggest of the 3,000 slums in Calcutta. 70,000 Hindus and Muslims live in this horribly overcrowded and impoverished city the size of 2 football fields. This tiny city has the highest population density in the world, where there is an average 12 square feet per person in which to live. Many families live in the street, in whatever piece of pavement there is. The city's name is ironic. In English, Anantnagar is City of Joy. With me is Dominique LaPierre, who lived there for 2 years and wrote a book about his experiences titled City of Joy, which has just been published in paper by Warner Books. Through a previous book about India, Freedom at Midnight, LaPierre became involved with the plight of India's poor. In 1981, he and his wife adapted a home for 150 children of lepers in the north of Calcutta. It was during a visit to this home that LaPierre and his wife discovered the City of Joy. They spent 2 years discovering it. LaPierre observed births, marriages, and cremations, learned to eat on less than 6 cents a day, how to wash himself with less than a cup of water, and how to pull a rickshaw carriage as a human horse, a chief occupation for Calcutta's poor. He also observed the heroic relief work of selfless, tireless individuals like Mother Teresa. Dominique LaPierre is well known for a series of international bestsellers co-written with Larry Collins, including The Fifth Horseman, Is Paris Burning, and O Jerusalem. He now divides his time between his home and writing base in France and different areas around the world where he does research and relief and fundraising work. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Good day.
How did you get involved with this one slum that is known as the City of Joy? Were you looking for a book there?
No, not really. You mentioned that I had published in 1975 a book called Freedom at Midnight, which was about the independence of India. And researching for this book gave me a real love story with India. And when this book was such a big bestseller, I decided to earmark a portion of my royalties for a good charitable cause in India, to show my gratitude to the Indian people who had given me so much hospitality. And one day with my wife, we flew to the city of Calcutta. Now, for us, you know, in our imagination, Calcutta is really the hellhole, the greatest urban disaster in the world. We thought that we could find there an institution which would need that money. And we went to see Mother Teresa. It's really the symbol of international charity, of fraternity. And we went to her and we said, Mother, I've put aside a share of my royalties on a previous book. Do you know an institution who would need this money? And she looked at me, you know, with a beautiful smile, and she said, this is God who sends you. And she took me to a slum, one of the 3,000 slums of that city, a place called, as you said, Anantnagar, which translates the City of Joy. And there we met an extraordinary Englishman who had founded a home for children of lepers. In the course of 15 years, this man, his name is James Stevens, had saved 5,000 children. He had no more money when we met him. So we gave him our money. And with him, we met other people. And we discovered that that place where 70,000 people live on a space of 3 football fields was really a place which fabricated heroes, Superman, saints, apostles. We met a young American doctor who had come from Florida to offer 1 year of his life to open a dispensary in the slum. We met a Catholic priest, Stefan Kowalski, who had come there, you know, not to preach or not to convert, but really to say to the other people, I am your brother, we are going to fight and hope together. We met a beautiful Assamese nurse, a girl who had come from the foothills of the Himalayas, just to be the angel of the slum. So you ask me, did I have an idea for a book? No, but when I met those people, I said to myself, these are the true heroes of today. These are anonymous Mother Teresas, and I am a writer. I've got to tell their story, their epic story, how those these people can survive on less than 10 cents a day and still, and this is very important, you know, still retain their smile, their power to love, their compassion, their sharing with others. It was such a lesson in hope and in faith that I really felt compelled to testify.
Could you describe the conditions that that you saw?
Well, then, you know, in order to put together that research, you really had to share the life of those people. So my wife and I, we went into the slum. We lived in a hovel, 3 feet by 3 feet. Those hovels, you know, have no electricity. They have no running water. Most of them have no windows. You have one latrine in a place like this for 2,500 people. This means that if you want to go to the latrine, you better get up at 4 o'clock in the morning if you don't want a line to queue up for 3 hours. There's only one water pump for about 3,000 people. This means that you have to queue up for 2 or 3 hours to get a little bucket of water. You have to learn how to wash with 1 quart of water. And there's a whole ritual to do that, and we adjusted to this. You have to adjust to cockroaches. You have to adjust to rats. It's really a difficult life. Now, of course, as far as we were concerned, I mean, there was one basic difference with the people living there. We knew that we could get away at any time we chose and that we could jump in a plane and go back to Paris. As a matter of fact, after 2 or 3 weeks in the slum, you know, we would be happy to go for one night in a 5-star hotel to get a gigantic bubble bath and drink a triple scotch and have a good cigar. But you know something? This is really incredible. After 2 days or one night of this luxurious treatment, we would miss our friends from the City of Joy, and we would want to go back with them because we really felt that we were living with a special brand of people, really the heroes of the world of today, those who can make use of anything. You know, you have to learn there how to light a match in the monsoon, to light the little stove to cook your food, but you only have one match. And when that match is damp or wet because of the rains, what do? And there's a whole technique. You learn about everything. You discover children who know how to remain children. They play, they laugh, they smile, but at the same time, they collaborate in the collective survival of their families. You know, I think if you ask me who today on the face of this earth is the person I admire the most, I'll tell you it's a little girl by the name of Padmini. She's 8 years old. She used to live right across the hovel where we lived. And every morning at about 8 o'clock in the morning, Padmini would show up in the front of our hovel with a beautiful flower in her hand that she would offer us. And you know something? I just don't know where she got this flower, because in a slum like the City of Joy, there's no trees, no bushes, no flowers, no birds, no butterfly. And yet she managed to bring this bouquet of flower. You know what she did? Every morning at 5 o'clock, she would leave the hovel of her parents to go up on the railway tracks which run along the slum to pick up in between the rails pieces of charcoal which might have fallen from locomotives. And some of those pieces of charcoal were still burning, and she would burn her little fingers. But she would put this little treasure under her blouse, go home, give it to her mother. Her mother would sell half of it to buy the rice of the family for one more day, and she would retain the other half to cook that rice. And Padmini is really a beauty, a gem of a little girl, and she was doing all that for the survival of her family. It's funny because about 2 weeks ago, my wife and I, we were in Calcutta. We went back to see our friends of the City of Joy, and Padmini jumped in my arms and said, "Brother Dominic, do you know something? Thanks to your book, The City of Joy, now we are not alone." Because the book, the English version of The City of Joy, has just reached Calcutta, and people are reading it in the alleys of The City of Joy. Those who can read, they translate it for those who can't read in Bengali or in Hindi. They get together, about 100 or 150 of them, and it's really the story of their own epic coming back from the West to them, written by a Western writer.
How has food divided up. I'd like to just ask you about how people survive there. How when there's a limited amount of food in a family, how is that?
Well, you know, it's usually within a family, the biggest share of the little food they have is always given to the one who works. If in a family there's somebody who's employed, he gets the biggest share because it's absolutely vital that he can continue being employed, because there are so many people being unemployed. In a place like the City of Joy, maybe 50% of the workforce is not employed. But, you know, you discover extraordinary things. When we went into that slum, we discovered that there was more than 950 workshops, which were in hovels, mud huts, making, producing every possible kind of products you can think of. I remember one day entering in a mud hut and seeing a group of workers there who just had manufactured a ship propeller, which was maybe 9 feet high, so big that you had to destroy, to tear down the mud hut to get it out. Now, how were they able to do that? I don't know. And another day I found in a room without light, without electricity, without even a window, other people, they were making computer parts with a precision of 1/5 of a micron. And then I said to myself, I mean, people who can do that are indestructible. I mean, they really show a will to survive, which is great, a terrific lesson of hope and of faith for us. You know, there is a beautiful line of the great Indian poet Rabindranath Tagore, a Nobel Prize. He says somewhere, adversity is big, but man is bigger than adversity. And that's the reason why I wanted to write The City of Joy. And, you know, this epic has touched millions of hearts. More than 15 million readers now have read around the world, The City of Joy. And I received 40,000 letters after the publication of the book. More than 12,000 letters came from the United States alone, from readers saying, you know, thank you for having given us this really lesson in hope. I mean, this has opened our eyes. Now we can appreciate our happiness better. We have everything in the West, and sometimes we don't know it.
Did many of the letters come with contributions?
Many of the letters came, and extraordinary contributions. I mean, we would receive from a group of Nashville high school kids a check and a letter saying that during their Easter vacation, they had sold flowers, and they were sending this contribution for the children of Calcutta. One day, I received from a couple from Chicago a letter with a sheet of paper on which were scotch tape two wedding rings. These people had sent their wedding rings to ask me to sell those rings and send the money to the people of the City of Joy. You must know that I give half of my royalties to the heroes of the City of Joy in order to try to improve their life. We have now just been in Calcutta with my wife, and we now support entirely this home for 200 children of lepers, this home which is called Resurrection. And when you see those kids there in full of health and joy and strength, and when you go with them, visit their families in this colony of lepers in the City of Joy, you understand how vital are such institutions and how much good they do. We also have 3 homes for handicapped children, and we have 2 dispensaries. And if, you know, the City of Joy, my book, becomes a bigger bestseller, we are going to have 2 mobile dispensaries to service areas near Calcutta which are totally deprived of any medical facilities. I know it's a drop in the ocean of needs, but, you know, as Mother Teresa says it herself, if that drop was not in the ocean would miss it.
In the slums of Calcutta, I would suppose that begging by children is a fact of life. It's a way that some families make
not in
their
the slum itself.
Not
you
in
know,
the slum.
It's strangely enough, in 2 years of research in the City of Joy, we were never asked, only given. Now, that's something really, you know, extraordinary, which deserves a little meditation. Do you know that in 2 years of research, I never met an orphan? And God knows that parents die, but immediately the neighbors would fight to adopt the remaining children. I never met a blind man or an invalid, an old man, a lunatic who did not have every day a house to get a little bit of food. You see a lot of beggars in India, but usually they are near the holy places, but because giving to beggars is something essential in the Hindu religion, or you see them in front of the doors of hotels for foreigners. They usually belong to gangs run by the mafia for begging. But in a slum itself, in a poor place like the City of Joy, never we were asked for anything.
Is begging seen as demeaning in the slum?
I mean, it just wouldn't come to the idea of anybody. You fight for your survival, you share, but you don't beg. What struck me, if you want, is that when I met all those people in the City of Joy, and that's why I wanted to write this book, is the extraordinary dignity of the people. Now, you can imagine, I thought, you know, that living in a slum after... You have to understand that all these people are farmers, usually, who have been chased from their land by some drought or a cyclone or a flood, and they came and piled in those urban jungles that slums are. But they manage, in those urban jungles, to reconstruct the civilization, the traditions, the culture of their original village. So they are not uprooted people. Every day there was a ceremony in that slum. There was some kind of celebration for an event of life or for some religious reasons. And it's really the dignity of these people, the way they fought for their survival, standing up, which gave me the idea to write the book.
When I was reading the book, and I think others that have read your book have also commented on this, The conditions that you describe seem so abjectly terrible. It's horrible overcrowding and people without homes and without food and terrible illness. But you write of it with such almost an optimism and a life force and not in a depressed way at all. Did you always have this sense of optimism, or when you first confronted this? Were you
well? I tell you, this is a good question. I mean, when you go to Calcutta, I mean, Calcutta has such a reputation. You expect to find destitution, to find death. This, you know, poverty exists, and I don't hide it, and I tell the stories in the book. But what you really discover is life. I mean, if really is a place in the world where you understand better the mystery of life, it's in a place like this. You know, I often think that if one day there's a Holocaust, atomic Holocaust on the face of the earth, and God forbids, the place where life will start again will be in a slum like the City of Joy, because people there have invented everything to survive. And it is this incredible vitality, this incredible power to make use of the smallest thing to survive, but to survive, you know, with smile, with strength, with beauty, that gave me the idea to write The City of Joy, because it's a fantastic lesson for all of us. You know, when I walk on the Champs-Élysées Avenue, or on Fifth Avenue in New York, or on Piccadilly in London, and I see people with somber faces on the walking on the sidewalk, you know, and I said to myself, those people have everything, and yet they look sad. They don't know that they have everything. And I have spent 2 years with people who have nothing and who still know how to share, how to love, how to smile. What a fantastic lesson it is for us.
My guest is Dominic LaPierre, and his book about the slum in Calcutta called The City of Joy, his book is also called The City of Joy, and that has just been published in paperback. How did the residents relate to you? You were there with a notebook, maybe a tape recorder.
A notebook. Well, you know, at the beginning, people always wonder who is this foreigner coming into their own life. I mean, is it somebody who's there just to peep for a few hours and then take a plane and go home? Or is it somebody who's there to try to understand? I think after a few days, they understood that I was not out there, you know, just to describe their poverty, because that's not what I was interested in. But I was there to understand the richness, the thickness, the dimension of their culture and of their life. And they adopted me, I must say, and they adopted my wife. Do you know what the biggest problem was during this research? It was to avoid that very poor people with whom I would spend an afternoon for an interview would not ruin themselves buying sweets or cakes or tea or chocolate or whatever to honor me, because the laws of hospitality in India are really so warm. So in order to avoid that such people would exhaust their last resources for this marks of hospitality, my wife had invented a beautiful pretext. She would say every time we would walk into a hovel and meet a family, she would say, "And please today, do not offer my husband any sweets, any cakes, any tea or any coffee. My husband today is fasting." And you know, fasting was a very Indian thing. Wives, even in a slum where there's so little to eat, wives fast once a week for the health of their husband. And when there's a kid who is sick in one of the compound, the whole community starts a fast for his recovery. So I was a sort of holy man, and they could receive me and talk to me without having to buy, you know, the marks of hospitality, without having to bring maybe the last earring to a money lender to get a few rupees to buy sweets or cakes for me.
India is such a religious society with a complex and very diverse set of religious beliefs. How were the conditions of poverty understood in terms of the religious belief system of the people that lived there?
Well, you know, you have the Hindu religion tells you that you are born in a certain, what they call karma, in a certain incarnation. You are born a rickshaw puller, or you are born a farmer. And if you really live your life in the most honest and the best way as possible, when you die, you will be reborn into a better incarnation. So in a sense, there is a certain feeling of resignation in front of the situation. But the people I've met were never resignated people. They were always fighting for their children, fighting for their family to better off their situation. The amount of work, the amount of imagination that they put in trying to get a better life was really an extraordinary example in the courage, in the capacity of man to survive the most tragic circumstances. I must say that one of the things that I discovered was really the presence of God in a place like the City of Joy. You know, whether people are Muslims or Hindus or Buddhists or Christians, it's really God with a big G. And I was very surprised, because if there's a place in the world where you have the impression that God has abandoned his children, it is indeed in a slum like the City of Joy. And yet every day there was some religious ceremony. These people had kept their links with their religion in a very admirable way. When one of the heroes of my book, The City of Joy, is this Stefan Kowalski, a young Polish Catholic priest who go into that slum to share really the life of the poorest of the poor. And when he arrived in the slum, he had only a little bag on his shoulder with his toothbrush, a copy of the Gospels, and his razor. And he also had folded an image. That image had been given to him by his father some years before. It was the face, the photograph of the Holy Shroud of Torino, the face of Christ as he was stepping down from the cross. So Kowalski put this image of the Holy Shroud of Torino on the wall. This was really the only decoration he had in his mud hut. Well, you know something? I've seen his neighbors who were Muslims and Hindus come every day to kneel down in front of the image of Christ and to pray. And you know, this was really something unbelievable. It's because for these people living in that slum, the face of that beaten Christ with his crown of thorns, his swollen eyes, were really their own faces. And whether it was Jesus of the Christians, or whether it's Muhammad of the Muslims, or Durga for the Hindus, it's all one big G, one big God. And really you sense in a place like the City of Joy, at every moment of the day, the presence of God.
Could you explain the origin of the name, the City of Joy, and also, how do the residents relate to that name?
It's a paradoxical name, you can imagine. Its Hindi name is Anand Nagar. Anand means joy, and Nagar means locality. It's the city of joy. It's been named this way in the 1900 by a jute mill factory owner who had given this very paradoxical name to this little area of land near his factory where he housed his workers. And in the course of time, this settlement became a real city, a city of 70,000 people, although it's only the space of 3 football fields. It's the highest concentration, human concentration, on Earth.
Do they relate to the City of Joy in an ironic way, the name of it?
No, not in an ironic way. I discovered that it was ironic, but if I wrote my book, The City of Joy, it's because I ultimately discovered it was indeed a city of joy. I mean, I saw more joy there, more people celebrating, more festivities in spite of the poverty that I would see in a whole year in our affluent cities of the West. And it's this unbelievable courage of the people. I mean, when suddenly you would see coming out of those hovels infested with cockroaches and rats, little children dressed up, you know, as princes with beautiful garments that they keep carefully in a box for the religious festival, you say to yourself, people who can do that are really, you know, truly the heroes of today. And that's how the book was received by its millions of readers, as really an hymn to life, as a song of hope coming really from the poorest of the poor. I'm very happy because I've received, you know, 19 proposals from Hollywood to film my book, The City of Joy, as a major motion picture. And I have given my rights to those who have filmed Gandhi, this famous film. And hopefully it is the director who has done The Killing Fields, Roland Joffé, that will film one day The City of Joy. And I hope that this film is going to be like the book, a hymn to life, a song of love to the capacity of humanity to overcome the worst adversity.
One of the occupations for many of the people that live there, many of the men, is pulling a rickshaw,
yes,
the two-wheeled carriage. And I
have brought you a little surprise. This is a bell which really is the noise of Calcutta. This is the bell of a rickshaw puller, of my friend Asari Pal, who's one of the heroes of my book, The City of Joy. Asari Pal was a farmer, you know, in rural Bengal, and one day a drought has really burned the field in which he was working and with which he was feeding his family. So he had nothing to do but leave for Calcutta, a big city of 10 million people, because in a big city you can always hope, you know, to pick up a few crumbs. And there he found a job as a rickshaw puller. I mean, as a human horse, actually, because, you know, the rickshaw pullers pull little chariots which transport passengers. In a sense, it's the taxis of Calcutta. There are 100,000 human horses in the city of Calcutta earning their rice and the rice of their family pulling other people.
Now is this seen as demeaning work by the people?
Not at all. It's something you learn when you go to Calcutta. There's no demeaning work. I mean, every bit of work which is useful to the survival of a family is good work. They rent their rickshaws from rickshaw owners. Most of those rickshaws are owned by policemen, strangely enough, and they give a rental every day and they keep the rest. A rickshaw who has earned in 10 hours of work in a monsoon or under the blazing sun of the summer, maybe $1, $1.50, can be lucky. And he will spend maybe 10 cents or 15 cents for his own food, and he will send the rest in a money order every month for the family that wait for him in the village. But you know, something which is wonderful is that the royalties of the City of Joy will also contribute to programs which will fight the roots of poverty. We are going to be involved in an irrigation program which will involve 19 villages with 200,000 people near Calcutta. Now, if you can give those 200,000 people the possibility of having two crops instead of one or three crops, when there will be a drought, those people will be able to face this calamity. They will not have to go and pile up in a slum in Calcutta. And before we left just now, before we were in Calcutta, we saw a marvelous event happen. A young couple of our friends were able to go back to their village. Now, I don't mean to say that a place like the City of Joy is going to be empty of its inhabitants in a very near future. I may not see it in my lifetime, but this is the trend for the future. Now, thanks to big irrigation program from the government, thanks to a massive use of fertilizers, thanks also to a better agricultural teachings, the land which has chased those people to the urban jungle of Calcutta will yield now two or three crops a year. And this means that less people will have to go to the main city. Maybe one day the slums will be empty. Let's hope for that. But something also very wonderful happened. You know, this book, The City of Joy, has caused a real shock in Calcutta. It has overwhelmed so many people that the municipal authorities of the city, have decided to launch a 10-year plan investing more than $1 billion to change the quality of life in the whole of the city. And they have called this plan the Plan City of Joy. And the first thing that they will do will be to install a distribution system for drinking water, a system which will give every day 80 million liters of drinking water to the population. And this is, you know, a vital thing because there is no drinking water in a city of 10 million inhabitants of Calcutta. This means that typhoid, cholera, dysentery, and all these are endemics. And this is going to be one of the first goals that this planned City of Joy will attain.
My guest is Dominique LaPierre, and his book City of Joy has just been published in paperback. The City of Joy, like I guess any other center, especially a place where you have people coming in as immigrants,
refugees,
yes. Has its own local mafia and its tiers of exploitation. What are the operations that the local mafia is involved with there?
That's very interesting because it's a thing which I discovered, you know, as I lived in that slum. I mean, when you move in a place like this, there are millions of things that you discover day after day. And one day, I must first tell you that there is absolutely no authority, no legal authority in a slum like the City of Joy. 70,000 people, but there's no policeman, there's not a mayor, there's no judge. I mean, there's absolutely no official authority. But there is an unofficial authority who is a mafia godfather who has installed himself in the only big house in the slum. It's a three-story house with all the comfort. And this man is a mafia boss, I mean, in all senses of the term, that means he controls the illegal sale of alcohol, the sales of drugs, the prostitution. He also rackets for votes for the political party in power. But at the same time, you know, strangely, he's also a sort of Robin Hood. Poor people can go to him and say, listen, boss, my landlord is asking for an increase in the rent, which is exorbitant. I can't afford it. You have to know that most of those hovels where people live, and imagine, and you must draw on your own carpet a square of 3 feet by 3 feet and tell yourself that 10 people at least live on such a small space. And in those hovels have usually 3 landlords, one for each wall, and sometimes 4, including the door. So when those landlords ask for a rent increase, a very poor fellow can go to the mafia boss and say, please help me to fight this. And this Robin Hood helps him in some cases.
I understand the analogy to Robin Hood, but on the other hand, he's living in such massive wealth, and his wealth is built on, in part, the poverty of the 70,000 people who live
there.
So how did you think about the Robin Hood analogy from that perspective?
Well, it's a Robin Hood on one side, and then it's total exploitation on the other side. Like, for example, there's a small colony of lepers in the city of Joy. About 400 of them are living in one edge of the slum. Now, the godfather is protecting them in the sense that the local inhabitants would like those lepers to leave the place. But he's protecting them, but at the same time, he's asking for protection money. And those lepers, who are the only beggars of the slum, but they don't beg in the slum, they go outside. They go in the big railway station, which is nearby, to beg on the platforms or outside of the station. They have to give a share of their begging every night to the godfather. And I tell the story in the book of an extraordinary event which took place sometime ago. The monsoon flooded the whole of Calcutta, and especially the slum, the city of Joy. And there were 6 feet of water, and most of the huts were dissolving in the water, and people were trying to escape. And there's only one building apart from the godfather's home. It's the local mosque. But that night, the godfather, with his own rowboats and his henchmen, was able to save thousands of people from drowning. I mean to say by that nothing is always completely rotten. You know, even the most devilish man, and this godfather is really an evil man, can at some point do something good. And this is what's so extraordinary in a place like this.
Was the Calcutta version of the mafia organized or reflecting at all the either a Hindu or Muslim set of beliefs or cultural practices?
Not really, but the mafia is organized after the pattern of our big mafias. I mean, I'm sure that if the mafia of New York or of Naples or of Marseille would know about the practice of the mafia in Calcutta, they would have a lot of teachings to learn from it, because it's the mafia in Calcutta is very, very well organized.
Does the local godfather in Calcutta see himself at all as a movie godfather, let's say like Marlon Brando in The Godfather? Or
I think he looks itself like a Mughal emperor of the old times of India. I don't think he has a connection. He connects with any movie mafia actors, but rather as one of those great emperors who have ruled India for so many years. He lives in opulence. He has a house with servants and beautiful carpets, and he smokes a big cigar, and he has rings at his finger. He's quite a character. Mother Teresa had a lot of problems with him.
How another interesting and I think very foreign element of life in Calcutta that you wrote about were the eunuchs there. Could you tell us what they are, who they are, and what their role was in the society?
It's really something very funny, because I found out about eunuchs, you know, almost at the end of my research. As I said before, every day, you know, I was finding out something new. The importance and of the traditions, of the culture, the dimension of that civilization is such that takes months and months to find out about things. And one morning, as I was waking up in the hovel there that I shared with Stefan Kowalski, the Catholic priest, I suddenly saw in the nearby hovel there in front of the door a beautiful woman with a sari, very elegant sari, very bright colors. And I said, my God, what is this beauty doing in this compound, in the slum? And suddenly I heard this person talk with a very harsh and low voice. And my friend Stefan Kowalski, the priest, exploded in laugh. And he said, don't get excited, Dominique. This is not a girl. This is a eunuch. And that's how I discovered that a community of eunuchs had moved in the nearby hovel where we were living.
Now, eunuchs are castrated...
Castrated males, yes.
Who had been castrated as boys?
As boys, most of the time, yes. And I discovered that those eunuchs played a very important role within a community like the City of Joy. You see, being cursed for the fact that they are neither woman, neither man, they have, according to the Hindu religion, this incredible power to purify the newly borns. In other words, whenever a baby would be born in some family in the slum, the parents, usually the grandmother or the grandfather, would come and see those eunuchs and pay them some money to ask them to come to purify, to perform a purification ceremony for the newly born. That means that they have the power to take upon themselves the sins committed in previous lives by the newly born. And so they have a musical instrument, they dress up with bangles, and they sing and they dance. It's a very picturesque ceremony, and the eunuchs are, I would say, almost the better off in the slum because they get paid for those ceremonies.
My guest is writer Dominique Lapierre. After learning and seeing so intimately the conditions of the City of Joy for 2 years and even before that, your other work in India, did you ever begin to feel either guilty or awkward about your own material wealth and possessions?
Never, Denis. I mean, one thing has to be straight. I am like I am. I love a good life. And if I wrote The City of Joy, it was not to give anybody bad conscience. It was not to preach anybody. But on the contrary, because I found so many positive values in researching for this book, I'm very happy today that thanks to a share of my royalties, thanks to all the donations that I've received from all over the world, I can help to improve the life of the inhabitants of the City of Joy. But don't ask me ever to go live in a slum because that's not what I'm made for. I like my comfort. I like my life. But if something was given to me, it was that I could testify. I was, you know, pushed into writing about this epic story. And I'm proud of having done it. And if this can contribute to better the life of those people whom I consider lights of the world, extraordinary people, well, I'm proud of it. But I'm not preaching at all.
Did your experiences in Calcutta change the way you relate to money or food or just material possessions at all?
Yes, I would say in a number of ways. It really taught me the real issues of life. I mean, I try now to be a wiser man in the sense that, to give you an example, when I come back to Paris with my beloved wife, we both try not to fight for a parking place. I mean, this has become, you know, somewhat irrelevant. I can't always do it because I'm very impulsive and all this, but this is one of the things we do. I think that this research has also taught us the real value of things. I mean, we try to avoid, you know, wasting things, throwing in the garbage can things which can still be used. You'll be maybe happy to know that the whole manuscript of my book, The City of Joy, was written on the other side of the manuscript of my previous book, The Fifth Horseman. Also, you know, when we leave a room, we turn off the electricity. I mean, that has become a reflex because we've lived for 2 years in a place where there was no electricity. And I think perhaps the last thing which really has changed us is that it's taught us to share more with others. You know, I did not even know who was my neighbor in my apartment building in Paris. I've been living there for 25 years. Well, Mother Teresa says many times, you know, you in the West, you have more poverty than we have in Calcutta because you have the poverty of the heart. You don't know who your neighbors are. You don't talk with the people living upstairs and all this. You don't share. And in Calcutta, this is unthinkable. So it has changed our lives in that sense, to be more open to others.
You've mentioned that part of the royalties from your book will be going to Calcutta, and your previous book about India also, yes. You donated money to India
right.
from those royalties. Do you feel that writers or journalists or other people who, filmmakers who do their work about the people of an impoverished area such as Calcutta have any type of moral responsibility to donate some of the proceeds back?
I think they do. You know, I think that I couldn't understand somebody spending 2 years like me with people you really learn to love. I mean, if you don't love them, why work with them? Without wanting, you know, in a way to help them improve their own life. I mean, without wanting that this presence of yours for those 2 years will have some kind of beneficial result. I mean, I just can't believe that. And now we've just been in Calcutta with my wife to make sure that, you know, the money we're sending, every cent is really used as it should be used. We are not the Red Cross. We have no overheads. We don't even have a secretary. We have converted one room of our own apartment in Paris in a sort of a center to receive all the mail and process all the checks and all this. Fortunately, my wife is from a family of 9 children, and she's got 6 sisters, and it's her own sisters who come at night to open the thousands of envelopes that we receive to put the checks in the bank, to send the money, to, you know, to hold all the records and all this. And we make sure that every cent we receive or we donate will be used for the right purpose. And that's something very important.
Do you ever get impatient with the more privileged members of the world who don't, you know, who live well, for not doing more to help?
I don't get impatient. You know, I think that each one should do what he wants to do according to his conscience. I think that a book like The City of Joy, by opening the eyes of many people, by telling a great story, has touched many, many hearts. And we have had people, very rich people, come to us and say, I would like to write my will for the heroes of the City of Joy. Now, that's beautiful. I am against preaching. You know, I don't like somebody on television telling me that I am a bastard because I eat 3 times a day, because I have a car. I don't like that. I don't think that's the way you should approach things. I think you should approach things the way I've tried to do it in the City of Joy, by telling the readers about a heroic story, about great people, and that has really induced a lot of people to be more interested. And if the rich can become more interested, so much the better. Mother Teresa herself, tell to the rich, become richer, but use a share of your wealth for those who are poor.
You had mentioned earlier a feature film that you're hoping to have made, and also a TV miniseries that is in the works on that. Let me ask you first about the TV miniseries.
Yes, I've written a script on the life story of Mother Teresa, and I hope to sell the script to a U.S. network, and that one night we'll have a prime time night for some great occasion on the life of Mother Teresa. And also now the motion picture, which will be filmed from the City of Joy, and I hope that all this, you know, will serve a good cause.
Well, if the television project comes to pass, I'm wondering if you're at all concerned about the potentially schlocky showbiz elements, which, when you do television miniseries, regardless of what the subject is, it almost seems inevitable that the subject will get trivialized in some way. Are you concerned about that?
Of course, I'm concerned about that.
How would you try to guard against it?
I think my job to make sure that this will not be trivialized. I think, you know, the life of a woman like Mother Teresa, or the life of this Catholic priest or this young American doctor I have in my book, The City of Joy, are so extraordinary in themselves, so epic, that you don't have to trivialize them to make them more palatable. I mean, they are so wonderful by themselves. The thing will be just to, you know, to feature them as the truth.
Will you want some type of artistic control?
Yes, some type of historical control. I mean, to make sure that they are not going to change those characters who are so marvelous in themselves, they don't need to be changed.
Did you have to do anything to get Mother Teresa's blessing to...
Yes, I signed a contract with them. She gave me the exclusive right to portray her own life.
And what did she want to know from you about how this would be done for her to...
Well, her only request was that this film would serve the cause of the poorest of the poor.
Now, if this film gets made, or the television miniseries, or the feature film that you had mentioned, I'd imagine that to make the film, one would have to spend $1 million or more than $1 million. And, you know, in spending that amount of money about the story of a city where the poor there live on less than 10 cents a day, I'm just wondering if that seems ironic to you at all, just the way the world works out.
It may seem ironic, but what if this film, which has cost $1 million, touch the hearts of 40 million people and invite them to participate and to share more with the poorest of the poor? I mean, the result really justifies the spending.
So you are hoping for a fundraising result out of...
If not a fundraising result, but at least I'm hoping for opening the hearts to induce people to be, you know, more prepared to share with others. And I think that's a beautiful aim.
Do you have any ideas or thoughts about who you would like to have play yourself in either one?
Oh, well, no. I mean, I don't want to appear in any film. And the story I give, you know, in The City of Joy, I'm not in it.
Why not? Why didn't you put yourself in the book?
Because I wanted to, you know, be at a distance. I was only a writer giving a great story. And it is not the story of Dominique Lapierre researching in the slum. It's the story of the people of the slum, how they survive, how they beat the odds, how they triumph over adversity. And I thought that this was the best way to present it.
What's the nature of how you keep in touch with the people of the slum now?
Now we constantly, you know, I've just been there now for 4 weeks, and it was a fantastic experience to go back and to meet all those people about whom I had written, and they all realized. I think the most beautiful homage that I have received was from this little girl Padmini that I tell the story in The City of Joy, when she came up to me and said, "Thanks to you now, Brother Dominique, we are not alone anymore." I mean, this is, you know, marvelous that these forgotten people on the face of this earth have a voice. They have a face. And this voice and this face can be an example to all of us. I think that, you know, I should be proud of that.
I want to thank you very much for being on Fresh Air today.
Thank you very much for having received me.
And my guest has been Dominique Lapierre. His most recent book is called The City of Joy, and it's just been published in paperback. Dominique Lapierre is also known for a series of best-selling novels, international bestsellers, which he has written with Larry Collins. It's 4 minutes to 5 o'clock, and at 5 o'clock we'll hear tonight's edition of All Things Considered. And tonight and for the next 2 weeks, you can hear Terry Gross as a guest co-host on All Things Considered. I'll tell you what's coming up tomorrow on Fresh Air after this word from Shadow Traffic.
Traveling, there's a 25-minute delay between Glenwood and City, westbound 25 minutes, approaching the Roosevelt Boulevard out through Belmont Avenue. On the eastbound Pennsylvania Turnpike, traffic is jammed, maybe a 5-mile delay there between Norristown and Fort Washington. There's a crane that fell over, blocking the right-hand lane. Everything has been cleared in Upper Marion with a gasoline spill, except for South Gulf Road. It remains closed between 202 and Church Road. Traveling out in Worcester, Route 73 is blocked just north of Route 363 because of an accident. That's Shadow Traffic, and I'm John Butterworth on 91 FM WHYY.
That Shadow Traffic report was from Philadelphia Business Journal. Tomorrow on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock, we have a special concert with William Bolcom on piano and vocalist Joan Morris. They're known for their performances of songs by Cole Porter, George Gershwin, Jerome Kern, and Irving Berlin, and they'll be serving up songs by all of those composers. Tomorrow at 4 o'clock, a live concert audience. Joan Morris and William Bolcom are in town to perform for the American Music Theater Festival Cabaret. They'll be performing in Center City beginning tomorrow night and throughout the weekend. On Friday at 3 o'clock on Fresh Air, Amy Sallet will talk with Joshua Meyerowitz, who's the author of No Sense of Place, about how the electronic media affects our everyday lives. And then at 4 o'clock on Friday, my guest will be Anne Rice, author of The Vampire Lestat, who will talk about the lore and legends surrounding vampires. In just 2 minutes, we'll be hearing tonight's edition of All Things Considered. Tonight on All Things Considered, you can hear Terry Gross speak with Anne Rice. That was produced in Washington this afternoon. And also Noah Adams speaking with film director John Waters. Also tonight on All Things Considered, a new debate over the U.S. role in Nicaragua. The Sandinista government has taken its first American prisoner of war in 5 years of fighting against the Contras. There'll be a report tonight on the mission that ended in tragedy. Audrey Vlblaitis and Ron Barron have been the engineers for today's edition of Fresh Air. Amy Sallet is the associate producer. Marty Moss-Cohen is the assistant producer of Fresh Air. And Bob Carlin has been giving us production assistance this week. Also research by Ed Goppel. My name is Danny Miller for Terry Gross. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good night. You're listening to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Stay tuned for All Things Considered, coming up after this.
From the earliest plans for the nation's capital to Louis Kahn's expressive modernism, Philadelphia has provided the nation and the world with designs of exceptional beauty and distinction. Now the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts invites you to view more than 200 architectural drawings, which trace the vibrant artistic and historical heritage of Philadelphia's architects from colonial times to the present. This extraordinary new show, Drawing Toward Building, is appropriately mounted in Frank Furness's beautiful historic landmark building. Drawing Toward Building at the Academy of the Fine Arts, October 10th through January 4th. The Academy is located at the corner of Broad and Cherry Streets in Philadelphia and is open until 7 every Wednesday evening. For further information, call 215-972-7600. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. This is Noah Adams.
And I'm Terry Gross with All Things Considered.
I do not want my own credibility to be caught up in this controversy. The controversy may vanish, but when you are sitting alone, it does not go away. And so I've taken the step of stepping down.
Down from his job as Chief State Department spokesman, Bernard Kalb resigns in protest against the reported disinformation policies of the Reagan administration. The story tonight in All Things Considered.
Also, in Nicaragua, U.S. officials are denied access to an American captured by Sandinista troops.
Low birth weight babies. A new study shows they can go home from the hospital sooner.
We'll talk with an award-winning chef who cooks every night at a fire station.
Also, film director John Waters. First, this news.
I'm Frank Stachow. State Department spokesman Bernard Kalb resigned today because of the Reagan administration's alleged disinformation campaign against Libya. The Washington Post reported last week that the administration planted false information about Libya in an effort to destabilize the government of Muammar Gaddafi. Kalb today did not confirm or deny that such a campaign took place, but he said reports about it had damaged the credibility of the U.S. The State Department would not comment on Kalb's resignation. The State Department today criticized the Nicaraguan government for allegedly refusing to grant U.S. officials access to Eugene Hassenfuss. He's the survivor of Sunday's plane crash inside Nicaragua. State Department spokesman Charles Redman.
Our representative was not received by the Nicaraguan government, and we view this with the utmost seriousness. The rendering of consular services is an essential part of the function of an embassy. The Sandinista government has once again taken action to make that function difficult, and has raised the question of whether indeed a U.S. embassy can function normally in Nicaragua. We frankly cannot accept the delay in granting consular access, since the Sandinista government has apparently gone to some lengths to parade Mr. Hasenfus before the press, and considering the fact that a government spokesman stated clearly last night on American television that access would be granted.
Meanwhile, President Reagan today denied that the downed plane, allegedly carrying arms to Contra rebels, was operating under official U.S. orders. He also acknowledged that the government has been aware that private American groups and citizens have been helping the anti-government forces in Nicaragua. The Soviet news agency TASS reports that an American cancer researcher has defected to the Soviet Union. According to TASS, Arnold Loskin, his wife and three children, arrived in Moscow today after being granted political asylum. TASS says Loskin has defected after being fired from his job because he opposed U.S. foreign policy. The upcoming summit is having an impact on the budget debate on Capitol Hill. President Reagan accused Congress of helping Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev by attaching arms control demands to the spending bill. The House wants the president to continue to abide by the terms of the unratified SALT II treaty, among other things. House leaders say the president is threatening to shut down the government unless he gets his way on arms issues. The House today approved a compromise anti-drug bill that would institute the death penalty for drug-related murders. The provision threatened a filibuster to keep it from passing. Representatives dropped a provision from the original bill that would require the use of the military to patrol the border against drug smuggling. It hasn't rained since Saturday in eastern Missouri, but flooding problems continue to intensify along the Missouri and Mississippi rivers north of St. Louis. Thousands have been forced to leave their homes as floodwaters continue to rise. Jim Dryden of member station KWMU in St. Louis reports.
In St. Charles County, just to the north of St. Louis, flooding is worse now than at any time in recent history. All of the levees along the Missouri River have broken, and the towns of Portage du Sault and West Alton, which sit at the confluence of the Missouri and Mississippi rivers, have been completely isolated by water. Ray Kemp of the St. Charles County Office of Emergency Management says levees and dikes north of the confluence of the two rivers are causing those rivers to seek out new channels. West Alton is now under the water of one such new channel. That town is being evacuated this evening after desperate attempts to sandbag it failed. Almost the entire peninsula, which sits at the confluence of the two rivers, is under as much as 15 feet of water and is now accessible only by boat. And even though the Missouri River reached its crest this morning and the Mississippi is expected to crest tomorrow, emergency management officials say it will be quite some time before residents of the flooded area will be able to return home. For National Public Radio, I'm Jim Dryden in St. Louis.
Wall Street experienced its second double-digit rally of the week today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed more than 19 points to finish the session at 1803.85. Trading was active, with nearly 142 million shares changing hands. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange gained 32 cents. One of the stumbling blocks to achieving congressional compromise on a new money bill for fiscal 1987 is a battle among farm state lawmakers over a proposed cash payment for wheat farmers. The contentious item would give wheat growers their 1987 farm support payments in the fall of 1986. Other farmers would have half of their payment deferred until next year. Supporters say the provision gives wheat growers the money they need up front to plant their winter crop. But Democratic Representative Dick Durbin, who represents a big corn-growing district in Illinois, says the measure would give wheat farmers a tax break that his feed grain producers would not enjoy.
It allows them to take their income this year while they can still income average under the old tax code, whereas corn growers will have to take it the next calendar year and won't be able to income average, and of course that's a sensitive issue where I come from. So I hate to see this kind of a regional battle going on, or a parochial battle between different crops, but that's what's happening.
Durbin is a member of the House Senate Conference Committee that's working on the Fiscal 87 money bill. Threatened with the loss of its credit, one of the nation's largest steelmakers has told its employees to work harder or they may lose their jobs. Paul Eisenstein has more from Detroit.
The 2,300 workers at Detroit-based McLouth Steel got some unpleasant news in the mail this week. The ninth largest steelmaker in the nation, McLouth has lost $85 million over the past 17 months, and its key suppliers recently told both union and management officials they'll cut off McLouth's credit unless the company begins making enough steel to turn a profit. Production has fallen to as little as 2,000 tons a day. But in a letter to his employees, McLouth owner Cyrus Tang has warned he'll shut down the company's two plants on Friday unless that output increases to at least 3,500 tons. Union leaders insist the production shortfall is largely the result of a manpower shortage, along with aging, often malfunctioning equipment. But they're taking the threat seriously and have sent two letters of their own to workers, urging them to meet McLeod's demands. Both sides say they're optimistic McLeod's steel can be saved. For National Public Radio, I'm Paul Eisenstein in Detroit.
About 110,000 Ford Motor Company employees received nearly $82.5 million in performance bonuses today. That's about $750 for each worker. The lump sum premiums are part of Ford's three-year contract with the United Auto Workers Union. Federal authorities are investigating possible odometer tampering on some new Chrysler Motors cars. Chrysler confirmed the investigation is underway. A Chrysler spokesman said today that a number of cars driven by Chrysler employees in Detroit were stopped last week by highway patrol officers after the police reported finding disconnected odometers on cars operated by other employees. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
It's All Things Considered. This is Noah Adams.
I'm Terry Gross. State Department spokesman Bernard Kalb resigned today because he believes the Reagan administration authorized a program of disinformation. Last week, The Washington Post reported that top-level officials had approved a plan to generate real and illusionary events to make Libya's Colonel Muammar Gaddafi think the United States might once again attack. Bernard Kalb's resignation is the first in protest of that policy. A similar resignation occurred at the White House in 1983 when a deputy quit to protest misleading statements given to the press shortly before the American invasion of Grenada. NPR's Bill Buesenberg has more on today's announcement.
Bernard Kalb had been a veteran diplomatic correspondent for CBS and NBC before being picked 2 years ago by Secretary of State George Shultz to be the department's chief spokesman, officially an assistant secretary for public affairs. His brother Marvin Kalb is still with NBC. Today, Bernard Kalb surprised his former colleagues in the news media by quitting over the issue of the administration's disinformation program. Kalb would not confirm that there was such a program, but he said he faced a choice of remaining silent or registering his dissent. And even though the issue appeared to be fading from the news, Kalb grappled with it privately and decided he had to act.
The controversy may vanish, but when you are sitting alone, it does not go away. And so I've taken the step of stepping down.
The State Department has reportedly been involved in the disinformation issue, but Kalb said his guidelines have always been not to lie or mislead the press, and he has...